Well, okay. So now we're back up and running, and David is with us now, and we're ready to move into one small habit. I will read the header for that chapter, and then we'll decide where we want to go from there. As we struggle with the machine, beginning with one small habit, we can produce an alchemical fire in the machine's chemical factory, which will gradually transform our being. David, would you like to say anything about where we're go from here?
So we got to chapter 8, okay?
We survived somehow without you limping along. Although I must say, I haven't heard hardly a peep from the internet people.
Well, I would have liked to have heard it, and I think I'll listen to what happened on once on a harmless whim, because that's a fun chapter, and the idea of developing, helping strengthen our will. And now we go on to one small habit. And I think that the thing that will be interesting as we go through chapter 9 will be this idea that is in the header, this alchemical fire. And the idea there is we can produce an alchemical fire in the machine's chemical factory. And we're actually talking, if I may, about a couple of things. One is actually creating an alchemical fire. And yes, it actually is chemical and it's biochemical in nature, but we look at it more from the point of view of exercising a particular kind of attention. And I think that's what we're being introduced to in this chapter.
I'd like to make one comment about that. Identity, since we were just working with Search for Dr. Livingston, identity can be seen, in my view, as a chemical addiction. We maintain identity primarily or at the chemical level through, well, not primarily through food choices, but everything that we do to the everything we do that influences metabolism influences our chemistry, and that has to do with how and how much we exercise, how and how much we breathe, the posture that we maintain, and the way it impacts our breath and our digestion, and particularly what we expose ourselves to in terms of what we breathe and what we put in our mouths. And that's one reason why food habits are so difficult to change, because we tend to identify sometimes very rigidly with what kinds of chemicals we put into ourselves, whether it's alcohol, whether it's coffee, whether it's food. And that's because identity is very dependent on chemistry. And that can be changed by attention and some of the things you're about to go into, but it's also very impacted by these mechanical habits of how we work with our bodies.
Some of us are smokers, for instance, and it's hard to, that's one that you might be easily seen as a habit. And you can see, or some of us are drinkers, we drink adult beverages and things like that. And you know that that's a, so these are external habits that you can easily see, and you can say, oh yeah, that person has that addiction. Well, the whole point of it is that yes, those are addictions, but we also have addictions of the machines and habits, and they have, and I think what Teresa is telling us is that has just as much of an impact as those habits as our attention habits. And that's the excitement that we're getting into tonight, I think, and it is exciting.
Would you like me to read from the chapter, since you're remote, or do you have a book with you?
Well, I am remote, and for somehow in this remote disembodied state, I seem to be able to read also. And I do have a book, and I thought I would read a couple of paragraphs, if that's okay.
Jump in.
Okie dokie. So I'm just going to start on the third paragraph on page 91. Even though as non-phenomenal beings, we have no direct will over the machine, at least in the beginning, we can enlist the aid of the mental centrum in the tail brain. A small exact change can produce corresponding changes in the ordinarily inaccessible monasteries of the reflexive feeling and thinking centrums. After a while, with repeated efforts, we can gain sufficient leverage in the machine to activate the higher centrums. In ordinary life, we never change our comfortable habitual postures and movements, so nothing can happen outside the ordinary routine of the machine. Okay. So, gosh, that's actually a lot, you know, just two little paragraphs, and we're blasted with a huge amount of information. Does anybody want to take a shot at what it means by the ordinarily inaccessible monasteries of the reflexive feeling and thinking centrums?
I love that one. I'll do it. If anyone else, I haven't seen comments yet. If somebody else wants to talk first, they can jump in by phone or internet. So I see those as places that we can go in order to hide out, where we don't necessarily want to be interrupted by the real world and the bastions of our identity we can be pretty religious about. And so in a sense, it's like taking refuge in a monastery, even in the same way where a man who comes home from work might hide from his family behind the newspaper.
Ah, I usually do that when I come home. I hide behind, I have a cocktail, and I read the newspaper.
And your point is?
Well, I attempt to hide. What am I doing there is what I'm asking.
That's your monastery.
Oh.
Forepaw says the dog doesn't like it.
Well, yeah, but you can always kick the dog, right? But then it might bite.
Then you might have to come out of your monastery to do it.
I see. So what we're really talking about here is that we hide. I think I told a story about this friend of mine. He'd go out, when he'd come home, he'd close the door to his apartment. He'd lean against the door and sigh a giant sigh of relief. We go inside his apartment.
I think I'll take that on as my harmless whim.
That's a hard day too.
Although it might not be a good one because I might like it too much. It
well,
might reinforce my identity.
And the whole point of harmless whim is you take on someone else's characteristic like that, and suddenly you see a little bit where they live. So, go ahead.
Now, Sinhog said inaccessible monasteries, and that's interesting. Are they inaccessible to others, or are they inaccessible to ourselves? I think it could go either way, or it could go both ways, depending on how awake we are.
So the author tells us, after a while, with repeated efforts, we can gain sufficient leverage in the machine. Do you guys believe that? Good. Can you gain such leverage?
Pathworld does, Four Paws does. Yeah. World Worker,
okay.
Can you gain such leverage?
Hey, David.
I'm World Worker, by the way.
Oh, you are? Okay.
David?
Even if, yeah, go ahead.
With gaining leverage on the machine, is that part of why we're supposed to adopt a harmless whim? Because if we can adopt a harmless whim, at some point we can turn that attention to our own harmful whim.
Is that Diana speaking?
I'm sorry? Okay, thank you.
The whole point of it is that, yes, what tools do we have, what tools do we naturally have to gain some leverage over these inaccessible parts in ourselves? What tool do we have? And then the author goes on to say, even if we wished intensely to change the habits of the human biological machine, long, note this phrase, long impartial observation is necessary to be able to categorize the habits. So we come back to the phrase again, long impartial efforts are needed. So yes, we work with the idea of voluntarizing these harmless whims, because what does it do? What are we doing? We're exercising our intentionality, right?
Yes, and some of the initial work and the initial in the struggle phase has to do with gaining the capacity to observe impartially.
Okay, good. So here we are faced then, it says in the book, habits are so completely automatic that our non-phenomenal attention is blind to them. We are not able to study the habits of the machine directly, because when we exert our attention upon the machine, what happens? We've experienced it now. We start to pay attention to ourselves, and the machine wakes up. And we're not as asleep. Darn it. We're not as asleep, and we start to, those habits go away.
So then we hide out in the monastery.
That's right. The most difficult manifestations to observe are those tiny little unconscious habitual expressions of the motor centrum. Now, if we actually were working, let's say we're physically together, and let's say we were together every day, all the time, or at least we spent a lot of time together, do you think we could notice the physical manifestations of our work partners? Like, I've spent some time with Four Paws, Path World. They've spent time with me.
They're all saying yes, too.
Yeah, because they know, they can see my unconscious little, tiny little unconscious habitual expressions. So, and as Four Paws tells us, much easier to observe in other people. And the author goes on in the next paragraph and says, a work circle is useful for this because in the beginning, we really cannot see the manifestations of our own machines with enough impartiality. So, and then to jump ahead a little bit on the next page, but if we begin to begin a struggle to observe, okay, we begin a struggle to observe. Isn't that interesting?
What do you find interesting about that particular phrase?
Well, it's this effort at understanding is virtue itself, as they say. So it's this this effort that we put into it, we begin to struggle to observe. That's the juice. That's the rubbing the two sticks together that gives us the alchemical fire.
Rubbing the two sorcerers together.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Sinhog wants to know, do we hide out in the monastery, or is that hidden higher part of ourselves? Forpa says, I think we hide out.
Well, it's a nice analogy that that's where we hide out in terms of our mechanical self. You know, that's where we hide out. On the other hand, there are, as we begin the higher work of opening up, that's our higher self as well. That's where the alchemical transformation occurs. So what can we do right now is to activate this process of observation of small habits that we have. And, you know, if you have others that you work with, they can point those out. It might be the habit of speech. Like when you get into a particular mechanical state, you say a particular phrase, or your words, let's say, take on a, you know, like I have a particular speech pattern, and when I hear it, I can't stand it, right?
You mean when you say, that's all?
Yeah. I'll say something like, when I come to a conclusion, I'll say, okay, that's, or I've finished what I want to say, I'll say, that's all.
Silverdale says, inaccessible monasteries refers to our inability to know and understand and rule ourself. That is, how our thoughts are formed, how our feelings are created, why our physical manifestations are the way they are.
We don't know those things about ourselves. We don't know where those things form. And in at the beginning of observation, they're just there.
And he says, over time, the non-phenomenal self can find the answers to these issues and begin to change the historical personality. That's right. That's what happens over time. And you're talking about how we begin.
Yeah, exactly. So in the last paragraph on page 93, we can begin this process by concentrating on one small habit of posture, gesture, tone, mood, work, waking, sleeping, eating, tying shoes, something small, a little unconscious habit which occurs several hundred times a day. Find that habit. You shove your hands in your pocket. You know, it's like the same old thing we were talking about. You twiddle your hair or something. And so we place our attention on that. And if we look at this idea of, on the next page where EJ talks about cattle prods, you know, that once you start to see some of these things and you place your attention on it, you get an electrical hit back in a sense. You get a handshake back. And that's what we mean by the beginning of the process of the alchemical fire.
So Silverdale had ended his comment saying, this is the end product of the work of the alchemical factory. So there we have the beginning, we have the end. What's in the middle?
You tell me.
In my experience, what's in the middle is a series of faintings in and out of awareness and in and out of mechanicality with a gradual accumulation of attention and a gradual accumulation of will and a gradual capacity to observe from a neutral place without judging, so that we can own more and more of the parts of ourselves without having to buffer or having to turn away from observing them because of our interior judgments or discomforts.
Okay.
Silverdale says we become full-fledged members of these formerly inaccessible monasteries. Yes. In the middle, the non-phenomenal self is growing in an organic way, like the physical body, the maturation of thought and feeling.
We have a whole part of ourselves that, in a sense, has been unfed, and we're trying to nourish it. And we're trying to build it. So we build, we're talking about building the will, like in the last chapter. And now we're trying to build this access points. And of course it's not easy. But we all can say to ourselves that yes, we've begun to have glimpses and a glimmer of a new state and a new possibility here. I think that's what we would help drives us here a little bit too. Okay. So, do we have our work cut out for us this week? I think we do.
Forepause, yes, with a sigh. Forepause, is that sigh against the inside of the door, perhaps?
Yeah. So we'll watch these things. And what I'd like to hear next week a little bit, if people can report back, do you have a sensing of this concept of the alchemical fire? Do you have a, because that's where something new is forged. So as you're observing these mechanicalities, also sense, have place in their sensing, oh, that's what it feels like.
Tell us your experience of that. Sorry. Tell us what it feels like in your body or energy or wherever you find it. Where are you finding it in yourself, and how are you sensing it?
For me, the sensing of that is something that takes place in the, I call it maybe the solar plexus area, the middle of the chest area. And I, when I'm on with that, I can feel an activation occurring as I begin to observe these things, and that when I hold my attention on it, I can feel the activation. Okay? And I sense that I'm on. I sense more than anything that I'm headed in the right direction. And as I hold my attention on it, I do have a feeling, it does sense, it does play out, and I can see why the alchemist said this, it's like a fire. It's a cleansing radiation that is occurring at that time.
That's very important, because it's very closely aligned with the sense, the interior sense of personal guidance. It's very related to knowing whether you're on the right track or not at a intuitive level. It requires almost the same process.
Nice.
Now, Silverdale concurs with what you said, and before that he said, all of life is a struggle against eternity in which the non-phenomenal self, which is eternal, struggles with patience to evolve the historical personality. And that is symbolized, if I'm not mistaken, by the Bodhisattva or Kuan Yin, who become enlightened, but then they hold open the door for every one of the unenlightened humanity to walk through before they move on.
Nice.
Okay, any other comments or questions?
I'd just like to make a comment. I'm glad I made it back in time.
I'm sure everyone was glad to have you back as well. So, that being said, this concludes our 9th Practical Work on Self work group. We will convene again next week and work on the chapter. We'll discuss the chapter One Small Habit and our exercises and personal experiences and move on to begin with chapter 10, Mentation. So
I'll be in the hot seat.
Good night, everybody. And
good night.
It was wonderful to have you there, here,
good night.
Everywhere.
Bye-bye.
Bye.